Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to the Coaching Coordinator Podcast. I'm excited to be joined today by the author of a couple books, which we're going to talk about here. One, Hybrids, Making of a Modern Defense, his newest one, and Cautious Aggression. And he also has a great website, Match Quarters, and that's Cody Alexander. Cody, great to have you here on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here.
Cody, I mentioned to you that on some of my trips I've taken here in January, actually both to Texas, so out your way, I spent some time reading your books while I was on the plane. And I've enjoyed what I've read so far. I haven't gotten through all of them, but just everything you're saying there makes a lot of sense. And you are truly a student of the game, and appreciate that you've gone through and thought about these things, and now you're sharing those ideas with coaches.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I always tell people I'm a football nerd. So anything I can talk football about or read about it or watch film, you know, I'm usually doing it.
One of the first things you write about, and I think it was in your first book, if I'm correct, Cautious Aggression, is you told your story. And I always ask coaches about their journey, and I was really fascinated by your story of how you got into football and your persistence in achieving a goal at the time of becoming a college football coach and getting your first GA job. So I was really just impressed with it, and I think it's a very unique story. So if you would share with our audience, you know, your entrance into this game, especially into the work you did at the college level at Baylor.
Yeah, I went to a small college in Oklahoma, Southern Nazarene University. That's where I finished school. Didn't have an opportunity and really didn't know what to do. You know, you grow up, you play NCAA football, and you think that, okay, the coaching world must just be really easy. It must be like a video game. You just kind of get a shot. And I never really knew anybody. So I really didn't have an opportunity. And most people in this business will tell you, and that have been around in this business will tell you that it's not what you know, it's who you know. And so me knowing that I didn't know anybody, my head coach at the time at Southern Nazarene didn't have any college connections. I didn't want a GA where I graduated from. I had an opportunity to coach at a really good program in Deer Creek, high school in the suburbs of Oklahoma City. And so I kind of had that opportunity. I went ahead and took it. While I was teaching there, my wife was finishing up her degree. And then once she graduated, I took the very first job I could possibly get, in Texas. It was at the time, a little 2-way charter school here in Waxahachie, Texas, which is where my wife is from. I mean, it was the only place that would give me a varsity job because I wanted to work varsity football. And if you know anything about the state of Texas, it's very much a kind of earn your way. A lot of coaches start at the middle school level, especially young coaches. But I kind of had a feeling that, you know, I wanted to do something a little more, and they gave me an opportunity to do that. And then while I was there, I just wanted more, and I wasn't being fulfilled. And I had that dream of coaching college, and I didn't necessarily know how to do it. So I called every local college in the Dallas area. So I called TCU, SMU, UNT, and then I decided my sister-in-law at the time was getting her degree from Baylor. And so I figured, you know what, I'll take a shot in the dark. It maybe not in the Metroplex, but I'll go ahead and call them. And so I called the director of football operations there, Colin Schillinglaw, and he was gracious enough to be very nice. There were no guarantees. He just was kind of like, hey, if you can get down here, I'll at least give you something to do. I can use the help. And if anybody knows anything about Art Briles, he does not keep a large staff around him. You hear about all these big staffs at some of these Power Five schools. I mean, we had a very skeleton staff. It was very, very much close knit. And so he was like, I'll help. So I took the GRE. I got enrolled in the school because I figured they can't tell me no if I'm already down there. I figured that if I, if I at least got into graduate school, I guarantee you that by the end of the first year, if they will let me work, they'll allow me to stay around. And if not, I just get my master's. Well, one day I was sitting there and I had done a bunch of paperwork and I had traveled around with the camps and things. And that one day I was sitting there and Phil Bennett would walk by me every day. And I would always have my feet up and I would always be reading my textbook because I was like, well, if I'm going to be paying for my master's, I might as well at least get my master's and do a good job with it. And so one day he just kind of asked, you know, who are you and what are you doing? And I explained to him what I wanted to do. And he was gracious enough to allow me to start sitting in meetings. And I started asking questions. And then Casey Horney, who is now at Texas and at the time was the defensive quality control, he just started feeding me work. And then eventually, by about the fourth week of the season, I was running our scout team. I was leading scout team meetings. And by the end of that year, I was doing all of our opponent scout. I did all of our JUCO recruiting and I kept our recruiting board. And so it was just, you know, I got lucky and was in at the right time. The NCAA decided to expand the GAs from 2 to 4 that next spring. And I had felt that I had worked hard enough and that I just, you know, I would be blessed if they would give me an opportunity to stay on. And they did. So I was blessed enough to get the GA job. And then I GA'd there for 2 more years. So I worked a total of 3 years and I couldn't have asked for anything better. I was there during RG3's Heisman Trophy winner. We beat UCLA in the Alamo Bowl the Holiday Bowl. And then I was there for our first Big 12 championship. So I guess I got kind of lucky.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty neat how, you know, your interaction with Coach, and initially you thought, you know, this guy's not going to give me any work, you know, he was blowing you off, but how he did really kind of take you under his wing a bit and allow you to show what you could do, that you really proved to be a self-starter in that. And I think there's just a great lesson in that for really any young coach today, that if you want to do something, you can't sit back and wait all the time. You might have to maybe wait for some kind of initial assignment, but once you have something, you got to take it and run with it.
Yeah, I think too, it's important to ask the right questions. You know, I'm a coach's son. My dad is a longtime coach in the Kansas City area. He was been an offensive coordinator for a long time as well. And so I've always been around football. And so I kind of knew how to act in the office and in meetings and kind of what questions to ask so that, you know, it looked like not that I was trying to trick anybody, but you look like you kind of know what you're doing and you're learning. And so that they would then be interested in saying, okay, he's kind of getting the thing and getting what we're doing. And, really, you know, you can't say no, especially in your first year, you really can't say no to anything. There's not a job that's too big. There's not a job that's too small. I think you got to also be able to understand when to ask for help. I think I got in trouble with that, that first year. I mean, I was probably in over my head. I needed help. But you know, you can't say no in that profession. Mm-hmm. And so especially when you're a young coach and you're just starting out, but being able to find out foster some friendships with some of the lower rung guys that can help you out and get you to where you need to be. But Phil Bennett is still my mentor. I talked to him. Actually, I talked to him today. He's a great man and he has done nothing but, you know, outside of my dad and my grandfather, he's probably right up there as most influential man in my life.
Well, from there, Cody, you know, fill in the gaps for us from the time you're at Baylor to where you're at now at Midlothian.
Yeah. You know, everybody tells you, you know, everybody goes into the whole GA process thinking that you're going to get this job, that the next move you're going to make is a full-time job. And, you know, you kind of have these aspirations. Like I said, it's kind of like you think you're in this like video game, like it's just going to, a guy's going to get hired off the staff and you're automatically going to go there, or one of the connections is going to get you there. And, you know, a lot of people don't understand, especially outside of the, at least the FBS level, kind of the different politics within getting jobs. I think that it really boils down to, you know, who you know and kind of what's the availability, what the AD is going to allow, how many brand new coaches is the AD going to allow. You know, there were times where I know Coach Bennett would call for me for a job to try and give me an interview at a certain place, and they would be like, I got to have a veteran, or my AD is not going to let me hire GAs, and certain other issues that you run into in the profession of just hiring. I had a son while I was a GA, and that's part of the other problem. I wouldn't say it a problem, but that was part of the other issue with me, is that a lot of times, a lot of guys, especially that are my age, you've GA'd a few times, or you've GA'd and you've taken a quality control job, or you take a job, and then it's kind of like that third job is when you get that full-time job. And for me, I didn't really have that luxury. My wife was a teacher. I had a son. In fact, I have a picture of my oldest son, Duke, who I'm holding as we're walking to the jet to fly to Phoenix for the festival. So, I mean, he's 9 months old, and so it was kind of one of those deals where everybody around me knew I needed to get a job, and it just didn't work out. I mean, and it's been a blessing, because a lot of the opportunities that kind of slipped through my fingers, or I just didn't quite get, all those jobs ended up being probably good that I didn't take that job. And so I went back to the high school level here in Texas, because one, you get paid really well. You're around top quality facilities, and you're around some of the most top quality coaches in the country. It's very competitive here. You get hired to get fired here, much like you do in college. People move around the state. It's very much geared towards football. And I think for me, you know, that was important for me. If I'm not going to coach at the college level, that I can at least make a living, take care of my family, and then also be around a competitive nature within football.
And Cody, you started getting into, I can't remember when I first saw you on the internet or getting involved in Twitter, but you started getting active and just sharing your ideas out there. How long ago did that start for you?
Yeah, so that's actually the genesis of this all, is one of my best friends got fired. When I left Baylor, I was a co-defense coordinator at a 6A school in the Dallas Metroplex. It wasn't quite the fit that I was looking for. And then I got the opportunity to move to Lovejoy High School, which is kind of east of Allen High School. Most people know where Allen is. It's one of the premier programs in the country. But Lovejoy is a smaller school that kind of sits in a suburb of Dallas, and I was able to get on there, and I was going to be, you know, a defense coordinator, which is something that, you know, again, I wanted to do. And after that first year I was there, like I said, in Texas, I mean, you can get fired at any time. And so I was part of that, and the head coach got fired. And I knew I wasn't going to be the coordinator, and so I needed a creative outlet. And so I I've always loved writing. I've always wanted to write, and I never knew kind of where to put that need and want to. And so I just finally, my wife was like, why don't you just start writing about football? And I was like, yeah, it's probably a good idea. And so what I just did is I just started writing about things that interest me and what I would do, and putting my philosophy on a paper. And I just was like, the worst place you can put it is on the internet. And so I just started putting it on the internet, because people are going to tell you if it's dumb or not. So it started out as more of a creative process for me. People started liking it. I started meeting different people that were influential within me writing the first book. I got told by multiple people, hey, man, you should make these articles into books. Chris Brown of Smart Football was really big in that. He was talking about how he made his books using his website. And so I just kind of took my foundational things, and I wrote my story, and then I kind of wrote my manifesto of football, everything that I learned from working with Art Briles and Phil Bennett, and then kind of putting it in the perspective of being a high school coach, because I had been a high school coach for 2 years. And so that's the kind of the genesis of everything. And it's kind of, for me, it's been fun to watch it grow.
Definitely. It's been fun to watch you grow here over the course of the years. And, you know, I remember when you put your first book out. I just got around to buying it, but right. I think you've done a great job with that. I really, you know, the first one, there's two main sections, the why and the how. And I just love that organization of it, and what you put together for some of the different rationales behind things like using too high, defending the spread, defending RPOs, et cetera. And then giving the specifics of how you would go about doing that. I think that's just a great format of teaching coaches out there. So I would highly encourage all of our listeners to check out your books, and we'll share the links in our show notes, and I'll let you share some links at the end of the show here too. But if you would kind of give us a brief synopsis of your first book, Cautious Aggression. Of your first book, Cautious Aggression, Defending Modern Football.
Yeah, so Cautious Aggression is really, like I said, it's kind of my manifesto of defending football, especially defending the modern offenses. And it's everything that I learned when I was at Baylor, really defending what I consider one of the greatest offenses ever assembled under Art Briles. I think I have a unique way of looking at defense. I think it comes from being raised in a home where my dad was an offensive coordinator. I'm very much offensive oriented. I love offense. I like studying offense. I grew up drawing offense, and then it just so happened that I was always on the defensive side of the ball. And so I've kind of grown in my love for defense, and then really being at Baylor and the way that Bennett looked at things and learning about his different history and how he moved from one style of defense to the other and why he did the things that we did and kind of doing some innovative things that we did at Baylor to kind of play. You know, we didn't have the greatest talent in the Big 12, but we ended up winning 10 games in our first year. And then ended up winning the Big 12 championship by 2013. And we did that really with keeping things very simple, packaging defenses, and schemes to be able and keeping it just aggressive enough that it put pressure on offenses to make mistakes and things like that. And so really what I did is in Cautious Aggression is talk about the thought process that we went through and that I really embraced. It was interesting being a young coach and having ideas of my own. I've always been very ambitious and having ideas and then going and being able to sit with a man like Phil Bennett, who's kind of, I mean, people know he's notorious within the coaching, especially at the college level, and being able to sit with him and thinking, man, we are on the same page. Like I'm totally understanding what you're saying. I'm totally bought into that. That's what I wanted to do as a player. That's what I've wanted to do as a young coach, and being kind of, you know, it really solidified my idea of what we did and the uniqueness of it. And now as I've gotten further in the whole process, and then after the book has been written and I've gotten feedback from it, I mean, this is a lot of people have been craving this kind of information. And so It's just really unique. You know, I wrote a little book with no expectations. I put it out in the middle of summer, which I remember you telling me not to do, but I did anyway. And it's just kind of grown kind of just from kind of a grassroots movement, and it's done better than I could have ever expected.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, you know, saying that you're really an offensive guy, and when you look at, if you just look at you know, the marketplace, I think it's like 3-1 or 4-1 the offensive content out there compared to the defensive content. And you don't see a lot of guys on defense just really getting into the nuts and bolts of things. They might share some things, but it seems like the defensive guys try to keep things a little bit more veiled and hidden away from you know, the offensive guys as far as what they're really trying to do.
Yeah, I think that just comes with defense. We're a very reactionary group. We're very much kind of in the foxhole group because, I mean, the game that we play now, the modern game that we play in now, is so much offensive oriented. And I think that goes along with it. If I get something new and innovative, I don't necessarily want to share it with everybody and put it out there. And I think what I've always tried to do with all of my content is really just kind of stick to the nuts and bolts part. Mm-hmm. I've never sold a playbook. I'm not selling my playbook. That's mine. I'm not going to sell that. But at the same time, I'm not going to sit here and not talk about different concepts that can help you out and different techniques and and different ways of manipulating the defense, because at the end of the day, you know, there's a thirst for knowledge on the defensive side that's just not there. And that's one of the reasons that I started writing, because I was like, well, there's nothing out here that I really want to read or that's any good. And so I said, I'll take a stab at it. And that's what I've done. You know, I think it's funny. I tweeted out a couple weeks ago about the tight front. I said, I wrote about this in 2016. It got really popular in 2017. And now you can't turn on the TV without seeing the tight front being run in college football and even in the NFL. And so for me, it's just kind of funny that, you know, I wrote about it so long ago, and then it's just kind of slowly being, and people are now starting to find out, you know, find some of my older articles and things like that. And so for me, I've always wanted to put something out there that would be lasting. You know, with Cautious Aggression, I kind of went out and was like, I want to write, if I'm going to write something in 25 years, I still want it to be relevant. And so that's kind of how I went about it. And I hope so. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I hope in 20 more years that people are still talking about Cautious Aggression, or people are giving it to their kids. Cause I mean, that's kind of the dream, you know, that's kind of what I envisioned out of that book in particular.
There's a section on it. Maybe to just share kind of one of your ideas on the how defending formations into the boundary. That's something as an offensive coordinator I like to do, and I kind of got into it mostly because it would drive my defensive coordinator nuts in camp when we would run formation in the boundary against them. And then we just kind of got used to using it and started doing it more and more and saw how it was stressing a defense. But for you, what are you going to do when you do get a formation into the boundary? How are you going to approach that?
I think the biggest thing with formation in the boundary is you still have to have leverage points on defense. I think what happens with is people teach black and white rules on the defensive side of the ball. And so when people go formation into the boundary, it takes the leverage away from the field, that now everybody has been reduced into the box. And now you have all this huge space, and you got a little old corner and maybe a defensive end, setting the edge. And so I think with formation to the boundary, the biggest argument that I even said was just, you know, little tweaks. You don't need to just wholesale, you know, you should never spin into the boundary. You should never wholesale change your defense just because it's into the boundary. Just little tweaks and little there, because here's the thing. If I put three receivers into the boundary, very rarely are they going to run three vertical, but there's just not enough space. And so in this day and age of spread football, remember, the offense is doing the exact opposite of what they want to do by putting themselves into space. So if you overreact to it, now they've got you where you wanted, you know, being able to keep your backside safety. That's why I think having too high coverage is so important in the modern game, is because you have to be able to have a weak side overhang, and primarily your backside, you're away from the passing screen. If it's a single receiver side, it is going to be that kind of overhang, that alley runner, and being able to keep him leveraged to the outside so they can't run jet sweeps back to the field, or run option back to the field, or anything else back to the field. And then also you can't be too passive and keep everybody to the field and don't adjust to the boundary, because then you basically given them a perfect opportunity to run a screen. So for me, it's, you know, small tweaks, small adjustments. I mean, you don't have to wholesale change your whole defense just because a team gets into the boundary. You know, even let's say a team's going to 3-by-1, your overhang to the number three receiver doesn't have to necessarily remove himself completely out of the box, because the number three receiver is going to be really tight to the line, and they're probably not going to run a snag route. Because that's the big thing everybody wants to run with a conflicted overhang to the number three, is run a snag route. Well, you're probably not going to do that into the boundary. So it's just understanding why are they trying to get into the boundary. I think that's the biggest thing for me, is when I see teams, because I track it in my own breakdowns. I want to see, why are you getting into the boundary? Is it just because you're calling the formation to one side and it just happened to be in the boundary? Or are you trying to leverage somebody? Is there some kind of deficiency within the defense that you're trying to leverage by putting the speed into the boundary?
See, for me, it was kind of exactly what you said most people don't do. I was doing it because I saw a high percentage of the teams, they would adjust and play go into cover three. So I knew I'd get him into cover three, and then we actually did run our four verts. Now, we messed around with the landmarks because the spacing was going to be different, and we didn't necessarily, you know, if we're running it from the field, we're trying to hit, you know, both bottoms of the numbers. We're trying to hit both hash marks. With this, we kind of just condensed it. We're trying to take that one, you know, the free safety out of it, and it was all switch releases. So we didn't run a straight four vert in that area, and we'd switch release it, and because of the switches and a little bit more of the added distance, we'd find that window at about 12 to 15 yards rather than maybe like the 15 to 22 that people look at for typical four verts. But it was something that, you know, if hey, we needed to get our four vert going and we needed to take a chunk and, you know, we wanted to get them into a cover three, a lot of the times that's what we could guarantee by going that formation into the boundary.
Right. And if you read that that chapter in the book, you'll see that, you know, the argument is definitely going to be to stay too high, because like you said, you're going to take one of those receivers and try and run them to the other hash. Mm-hmm. And being able to keep a safety to the field, one, to leverage the run, but also two, to absorb any pass that might come to the hash. Now what you've been able to do is use your safety to the boundary to take one of those verticals along with the corner. So you've actually distributed it evenly, and you've kept your four secondary players high, yet you've still leveraged the field for the run with your field safety.
The other thing, just from a strategy standpoint, I like to do with it was actually do it with tempo. So we would be, you know, on one play trips to the field, we get the ball out there, it goes all the way to, you know, all the way across the field. Now, if I stay in that formation, my guys are into the boundary. And with a lot of teams, what I find too is like if we could go fast, that boundary corner who's used to having the sideline as his friend, we would try to stress him with our splits. So while you think about, you know, balls on the hash, you have your formation in the field, your X is going to take, you know, his split out. And we're talking 3x1 is going to take his split out on the boundary side wide. And, you know, your guys are going to spread the field to the other side. Well, you know, my thought process at least was I want to put that boundary corner who now didn't have the time to get over to the other side in a little bit of an awkward situation. I want him to have more space to defend, so we're not stretching all the way out there to the boundary, that we're kind of condensing and keeping that split the same as if that guy was that, you know, if he was into the boundary. So we condense it and bring it in a little bit, and it really allowed us to have a lot more space out there to do some things, whether that might be try to run some landmark type of fades and get the ball out wide. But definitely was something we found could put additional stress on the defense.
Yeah, I mean, I like formation and boundary. I think too, you know, with offensive coordinators, you got to get creative with it. You know, you got to make sure that you're self scouting as well, and you're not trying to do the exact same things, like put trips in the boundary and then motion the guy back for a jet motion, trying to get a jet lead or mm-hmm. run power read back to the field. I mean, if you're going to do it, you need to do it because the defense is reacting in a certain right. way, and then you're trying to take advantage of it.
Totally agree. Well, I love that stuff. I love that chapter on it, and a great look into, again, the why and the how in your first book, Cautious Aggression, which takes us to your second one, which you just released. Is it about a month ago now? How long has that book been out?
It was about a month and a half. It was about halfway through December.
Right before Christmas. And as I started reading that book, and I guess probably why I'm not getting through both is I end up going back and forth between the two, and I'm kind of reading it like a resource rather than reading it straight through. But
right.
As I read the introduction to it, what really resonated with me was the idea of having those hybrid type players. And it reminded me of coaching high school ball. And, you know, sometimes you just don't have those guys who necessarily fit the bill for what you think a certain type of player needs to be. And, you know, the one place where I really learned defense, I ended up being the head coach there, here outside of Cleveland in Amherst. And we had a guy there named Don Richardson who learned the stunt 4-3 defense directly from George Perlis. And he would go there every summer. He'd work his camps and then just hang out there, watch all the film, go through their playbook. And he brought the exact defense, all the terminology to the high school level, and we utilized it there. And for those not familiar with the stunt 4-3 defense, it really became popular with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and it was the Iron Curtain defense with Mean Joe Green and some of those guys. And it was really a lot of that, and the way we thought about it, at least, was we did have a ton of those hybrid players. I could think of, you know, having some years having like a nose tackle was like 175 pounds.
Right.
But he could run. He'd be able to take some of those gaps. And then with some of the techniques we had with, like, for example, our Tom stunt, which he'd be looping over to, we'd be an under front primarily in the stunt 4-3. And he'd be looping back over to the weak side. And if he saw, you know, run going away as he's looping, he would just restack things and essentially become a linebacker. So you have this kid who looks like a linebacker playing on the defensive line, and with some of his techniques ends up being like a linebacker as the play moves. And it just reminded me of, it took me back to that time and thinking kind of creatively about how do you use personnel. And I think that's kind of a big chunk of what you're talking about here with the hybrids, that you know, to defend some of the modern offense, which you do have, you know, God, you have tight ends who can, you know, run four or fives, and, you know, but they're still 6'5". So you got to be creative with how you defend it. And yet I think, you know, the heart of this is you got to have the right athletes on the field.
Yeah. And I think it's just what we've gotten to the point now is that every level of football now has to just deal with what they've got, and they've got to deal with space. And I think that was the whole argument with the introduction to hybrids, and this is going to sound shocking, but it does talk about soccer, and it talks about how the modern game of soccer has been molded into a game of space, and using wide edges to kick the ball back inside, to spread the defense out, attack the defense through the edges, and then try and swing back inside. And so I know that sounds counterintuitive to what football is about, because football is way more structured than a game like soccer or basketball. But even basketball, they talk about spreading the court. We've gotten to the point in basketball where now everybody on the court has to be able to shoot the three, that you have to be able to spread the court out, because that's where they've gotten to the point in basketball, is that is where offense has gone. It is using space and angles to gain points. Football is no different. Football has now gotten to the point where, yes, we're starting to see a more of a shift towards hybrid tight ends instead of actually going back to a true one personnel, 22 personnel. I think which is more sustainable is what we're seeing with, like, Lincoln Riley using an inline tight end and a flex tight end, and being able, if they need to, go into a 12 personnel package, but then also be able to shift to 11 personnel, go to 10 personnel, go to 20 personnel, all within the same packaging group, which is like the old school way of people used to do it. You know, you spread, you know, I grew up running the Nebraska Power Eye. That's what we did. And so your fullback every once in a while would go split out as a receiver. So you had to make sure that your fullback, if you're going to go into like an 11 personnel formation, you need to make sure you at least could catch the ball and he could have run a little bit. And so what we've gotten to on offensive side is now going to have to be matched on the defensive side, which is where we're seeing all the funky stuff in the Big 12. Everybody knocks the Big 12. And yes, I'm a Big 12 homer. I worked at Baylor. I live in Texas. But at the same time, what you're seeing in the Big 12 is really not just innovation on offense, but it is the innovation from desperation on defense. I mean, everybody, the rave now is to talk about Iowa State and the three safety dime and the broken stack, which I talk about in the book. And I talk about the tight front and how it's been, you know, a transformative front within football, even though it's really nothing more than a bare front. You just move the guys out to a four eye, or what people have been running forever in the Okie front. You're just actually putting them in, or a 505, which I call a buck front. You're just putting them in four eye. You're just putting them in the four eye. And so it's just kind of the evolution of football, of how do you space within the box so that you can spread out your secondary and your linebackers to defend these formations. And that's essentially what the tight front has done. The tight front has said, look, we're going to clog the middle because, one, most spread teams aren't going to run through the A gap, and we're going to play B gap, which I have always argued, if you go back into the very earliest post I've ever posted, is that is if you're going to defend the spread, you better change the B gaps and you better take control of the B gaps, because that's where a spread team lives. What we've gotten to now is with the four eyes is defenses have just said, look, we're clogging the B gap. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to cut off the cutback with the nose, and we're going to have that allows us to have that plugger mic. And that allows us to have an athlete at the other inside linebacker. And now everybody is able to spread out with the formation. And I think that's where we've come in the game. And that's what I argue in the book, is just that football has now become a game of space.
Yep.
That you've got to be able to react to the space that you've gotten, whether it's conduce space or whether it's spread out like the ultra spread that Briles was running at Baylor.
Well, that's it, exactly it. It is thinking about things within that framework of space. And, you know, you can do it a number of ways. You can create space with the condensed formation and adding extra gaps and certainly spread the defense out that way. I think back to Tom, probably 6-7 years ago, particular opponent we were playing, they were base 3-4 defense, and when you looked at them and how they were aligned, I mean, they had everybody within about 8 or 9 yards of the football. I mean, they brought everybody down against us. We like to run the ball, and it was no secret that we were going to find a way to do it. And I remember in that game my coach asking me, like, why do you keep running the ball? They got everybody down. I said, because with what we're doing, between how we were aligning in our formations with some extra gaps, and then also our backfield action, which we had this series in, I would say it had a very strong wing T flavor to it that we, on every single play, and it's what you see, you know, the Rams doing right now a lot,
right,
is we had that orbit sweep or you know, that motion behind on every single play in that action. And we had the quarterback going the other way, either with or without the ball, whether that was a naked. Sometimes we'd actually just block for him on a run. And then you had that play hitting up the middle. Well, you know, the safeties who came down to about 8 yards couldn't necessarily fit as well as if they were at, you know, 10 to 12, being able to read a little bit and react. They had to react now and stay out there. They had to respect that the ball might go outside with all the action there. And we ended up running really on, you know, what we would do if we were all spread out on a 3-2 box. You know, it went back to that. So
right,
there's a lot of creative things you can do with it, but your transition and the way you talked about soccer and then you talked about basketball, I love that and how you brought it into, you know, exactly where we are with football today and how you have to think about defending some of these modern offenses.
Yeah, I actually got the idea from Fergus Conley, who's written an amazing book called Game Changer.
Yeah.
It's a textbook on winning. And I don't know if that's ever been developed before, but I've read the whole thing and I loved it. And I loved the how he talked about the different styles of team sport, and really it's about team sports. It's not about individual sports. It's all about team sports and all the different team sports you see in the world, primarily the space sports. So basketball, soccer, rugby, and football. And he talked about all those sports and how they interrelate with each other and how the games are really broken down to triangles and space and being able to manipulate space. And this whole entire time, I literally, in my notes, I have little notes. As I'm taking notes, I would just put Briles and circle it, Briles and circle. I mean, because it was exactly what we were doing at Baylor, but we were doing it such a hyper speed and these uber wide splits. And we were basically taking all these concepts that I was reading in this book about, and I was like, this is exactly what we were doing at Baylor. And then it kind of gave me an idea for this is where kind of football is headed. And how can we counteract that with defense and kind of going, making it another extension of cautious aggression and kind of moving towards what we're seeing today and kind of where we're going to go back and forth. And, you know, I opened the book with the quote, time is a flat circle, because it truly is. I mean, look at the Patriots. The Patriots won a game by just running 21 personnel and shoving it down the throats of Kansas City, which is old school ball, which is ironic because that's where Marty Schottenheimer was coaching it. We used to play Marty ball. I remember growing up, Marty ball, 3 yards in a cloud of dust. And that's essentially what they did to the Chiefs to get into the Super Bowl. And so I think the objective is, and what I argue in the book and what I've always argued is that you can win with small ball on defense. And by small ball, I mean using hybrids and things like that, but you have to structure it in a way to keep your hybrid players in space so that they can function within space. And I think that's kind of the important thing in modern football is that you can't just wholesale and just say, look, we're going to run this. We're like, for instance, the Iowa State, we're going to run this three safety dime odd stack. Well, yeah, that works against, you know, the 10 personnel stuff, but then also look at what they're doing when they go up against Iowa. They're bringing in an extra D lineman. They're adjusting what their packaging is going to be, and they're attacking, you know, for instance, Iowa with the 12 personnel stuff. They're attacking them differently than they would Texas Tech with Cliff Kingsbury. And I think that's the important, that's the future of football, of being able to go from week to week, from going to see a power eye team, and then the next week you're playing a 10 personnel spread team, of how you can teach your kids, you know, and package your kids and create a defense to where you're really teaching more or less techniques and concepts, and not just these rigid positional groupings that we've grown up with. You know, Football Outsiders, I mentioned it several times in the book, Football Outsiders doesn't even, when they look at NFL stuff, they don't even acknowledge the fact if it's a 4-3 or a 3-4 anymore, because most people are playing with a hybrid defensive end. And I would argue that's the case at most Power 5 schools now, is that one of your DNs is able to stand up and drop into coverage.
Yep.
And I think that's the key in the future of defense, is being able to create a playbook and of concepts, and being able to teach different techniques to different players so that they understand, when I'm in the game and I'm in this position, this is how it's going to be. Because, you know, you can have the same blitz, but you can give it a different look from a different package. And that's nothing new. But as we go further in, and teams are starting to play more with guys that can run, because you've got to be able to defend 12 personnel, ace one play, and then the next play they're in 11 personnel, the next play they're in 10 personnel. You know, you got to be able to go and bounce around that, especially with the hybrid players that you're seeing on offense that are being developed on offense. You've got to be able to match that on defense, and creating concepts to where it's fluid from one formation to the other. And that's where I feel like BTF, blitzing the formation and really just packaging and formationing your defense, so crucial in the modern game.
Well, Cody, you've done an excellent job with these two books, and I know you're a guy who really studies the game, stays up on trend. I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this question. I know it's only about 6 weeks since your book's been released, but what kind of things have you been thinking about recently? What maybe trends do you see developing that are going to need some attention and thought?
I think blitzing with the four eyes. I've had a lot of people ask me about blitzing with the four eyes, different things like that. The big term coming out of 2018 has been simulated blitzes, of where you look like you're going to send an all-out blitz, kind of that amoeba defense type deal where you're sending an all-out blitz, but then you're really dropping guys into coverage and they could come from anywhere. You know, you're blitzing different people from taking advantage of the pass protections. I think that's going to be the key. I think you're going to start seeing a trend of people asking, people have been so spread heavy for so long, hey, how am I supposed to defend the 21 personnel? How am I supposed to defend if somebody goes 30 personnel diamond? Because diamond was real big about five or six years ago, and I have a feeling it'll probably come back. You're already seeing the double slot tight ends, I think, out of gun, which is nothing more than ace. They're just put the tight ends off the ball. And so I think the Y off stuff, the bash stuff, I think that all that stuff, none of that stuff's going away. I think at the end of the day, it's going to boil down to, do you know your option rules And can you package a defense to where it can match up to any formation that you see, so you're not wholesale changing from week to week? And I think that's the things that I'm looking into.
Well, Cody, I appreciate you taking the time today and going through and sharing some of these ideas and all the work you've been doing. It has been really fun to see you grow as a coach, to see you grow as a thinker in this game and a guy who's able to write about those ideas and share them with coaches. And certainly would love to have you back on the podcast again in the future to just talk about some ideas. But before we go, I want you to give your information out here to coaches. So if they're not aware of some of the things you're doing, your Twitter handle, your website, go ahead and share that with us.
Yeah, so I run the website matchquarters.com. I have over 90 articles, I think, that I've written in the past three and a half years. There's things on there, everything from I just did an article on the Clemson offense all the way to some of my older stuff talking about just simple motion. And then I also I do most of my communicating with coaches through Twitter. My handle is @the_coach_A. I always keep my DM open. So if you have a question, I'm always free. It helps me more than it probably helps the people asking questions, because it makes me have to think, and I got to make sure I dot my I's and I cross my T's. So I love interacting with coaches. And then obviously you can find both books, Cautious Aggression and Hybrids, on Amazon. If there's anything that you guys ever need, you can always contact me.
Cody, really appreciate it, and best of luck to you in 2019 here. I will finish up reading these books, which means I'll be waiting for the next one, so you could get to work on that.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, take care, buddy.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.